No, I didn't hear anything. Try me one more time. Okay, you're giving up on me too easy here. This should be an exciting show for everybody here. I've been in the MEGA community a long time. And what I'm seeing here happening in the MEGA community now is, I think, one of the great touch points. Really, only the second touch point that I would put on the MEGA outside of the original development. Long time ago, I wrote an article for Jason Compton's MEGA report. I was talking about all the development that was going on and the essentially the bright future that we could see. Now, I wasn't talking about any pie in the sky stuff. What I was looking at then was that the company Amiga essentially had been dead, what we were looking at was that a number of companies had done a good job in carrying things forward. Back then, we had Macro Systems had a Draco come out. There was essentially an Amiga, and we had a lot of other people coming out with essentially new Amiga hardware, accelerators and everything, and they were keeping the whole platform going all by themselves at the time. And now we come forward to this time, and we've got this sort of development going on in the community again. We've got the Amiga 1 and Amiga OS 4 under development now. We've seen a lot about that at the show here. We've seen Genesee, who have brought the Pegasus machines here, as you've seen, with MorphOS, with full Amiga compatibility. I've been in my own booth, I've been running and showing image effects running fully under MorphOS there. And we've also got Jerry Ellsworth with her compatible computer, the C1, bringing a whole new level of interesting development here. It's a whole new time now. We've got new solutions. We've got new hardware. We've got a lot more going on. And so we've got a lot of interesting stuff going on here. And the idea of the panel here is getting everybody together in one area where they could talk to you about everybody's vision here of what they've developed, why they've developed it, what their philosophy is. So to do that, we're going to start off with having everybody come up here and spend no more than 15 minutes talking about their own platform or their own products. Today we've got Ben Hermans, we've got Jerry Ellsworth, Jens Schoenfeld, and Bill Buck are all going to be coming up and talking about their platforms. Afterwards, we're going to field the questions that you all have been filling out. We'll allow you a little more time during the presentations and that they're going to give to fill out a little more questions. As you're filling out your questions, why don't we go ahead and pass them up here to the people at the front tables, and then I or one of the club members can collect those and bring them up to me. And we will go through those questions and allow the panel to answer to everything. And we all should have a really fun time here. We'll be learning about what's coming learning what we can do with it and learning how we can continue forward using the platform we love and the alternative solutions that are now being brought to us. With that, I'd like to invite Ben Hermans of Hyperion to come up and do the first presentation.
Thank you, Kerman. It's a real pleasure to be here. Was very tiring flight over from Belgium, about 24 hours in a plane, actually three planes. But it's always nice to be here at Amiga West, only my second time, unfortunately. First of all, I want to thank everybody for being here, obviously. And secondly, I want to thank everybody for actually being patient and waiting for OS4 whilst it's being developed and whilst it reaches a state that we consider it to be releasable. Today I got up really early at around about 5:30 to head over to MyLogic over in Fremont, and that's actually the reason why I was only here at around 1 in the afternoon. And to be honest, we were received by the president of the company, Jason Hu, just came back from Taiwan, and I was blown away by what they had to offer in terms of new hardware that's just around the corner. It turns out there is no less than 30 people working on the Amiha One platform, 20 of which are full-timers. There is a conglomerate of three companies, MyLogic over here in Fremont, California, who actually designed the hardware and implement the Norbridge chipset. But they're working together with their parent company, Topshine Electronics from Taiwan, and they have about 10 people, Topshine has about 10 people working on pushing the hardware forward and implementing all kinds of new functionality. And there is a third company, which I believe, if I understand it correctly, is actually an investor or partner, joint venture partner with Topshine, which is FIC, which some of you might know as one of the largest companies in Taiwan producing PC motherboards. And they actually do the actual production and quality assurance of the Amiha One motherboards. And like I said, I mean, in total, there is about 30 engineers working on the Amiha One hardware, and 20 of them are full-time. Now, what's the last time that we had 20 full-time engineers working on the Amiha hardware? I mean, I think we have to go hard back to the Commodore days before we actually get that type of manpower that behind the hardware platform. And it's not really my task here to speak about the Amiha One hardware, because it's obviously it's not being produced by us, Hyperion. But I do want to share some of the excitement that I experienced when I was over there. We got the Amiha One Lite coming up, which is basically a mini ITX form factor board, 6 by 6 inches, or in centimeters, 17 by 17. And it comes with gigabit Ethernet, USB 2.0, FireWire, a CF card reader, so that you can actually boot the operating system from a compact flash for a completely hard disk-less device, which is ideal for multimedia and industrial controllers. And obviously the usual stuff, AGP x2 slot, but only one PCI slot, because we're basically looking for a very low-end entry model into the market. Think of it a bit as an Amiga 1200 or a Amiga 600. That hardware is just around the corner. I was actually quite surprised to hear that. It seems there's new revisions of the Amiga One motherboard lined up. I can't speak about the actual timeline. I mean, this is for Alan Redhouse and Mai to discuss. But technologies like serial ATA, gigabit Ethernet, USB 2.0, DDR memory support, AGP x4, they're just around the corner. I mean, that's what you get when you have 20 full-time engineers working on pushing the hardware platform forward. So I'm very excited about this. I mean, what we're seeing here is the beginning of something new. Now, another interesting thing was that it seems that in the meanwhile, the company that we originally signed on for the graphics card driver support on OS4, Zytec, which is located in Chico, California, and they actually have two Amiga One motherboards, which they use for their development of the drivers for OS4. As some of you might know, they are actually specialized in 2D driver technology, and they have a very advanced driver set with no less than about, I believe it's now 193 different chipsets that they support. Now, they've hooked up, more or less through our intermediation with Maya themselves. And these companies are actually working together now, Mai and Zytec, to push forward the platform in terms of graphics performance, multimedia capabilities, and so forth. So what we're seeing here is a conglomerate of hardware and software companies all coming together for a common goal. And whilst it's not the unified Commodore architecture where you have, basically Commodore did everything, I guess, we are seeing a lot of expertise from professional companies coming together with a whole bunch of investment behind it. And I haven't seen that since, 1994, I believe. And this time, the good part is that real Amihans are behind the wheel. And Maya has told me that they're not going to produce cheap knockoff PCs. and then go bankrupt. So I asked Jason Hu to put that on paper for me. So anyway, so I'm very optimistic about the hardware, about the stuff that we're going to see, continuous upgrades of the hardware going on forward. So there is actually no reason not to go out there and buy your Amiga One now, because there is always going to be something new around the corner. We saw the 7457 G4 in action, running at, I believe it was 1.1 gigahertz, and it was only putting out about 7 watts of energy consumption, which I think in itself is already quite amazing. Now, with respect to OS4, because I mean, suddenly we're the ones actually holding up the whole thing. So, you know, it used to be the hardware, but no, it's not. So, it's not finished yet, unfortunately. But we're like really, really getting there. So, I mean, it's been a hard 18 months. A lot of people told us initially that what we wanted to do, we couldn't do it, because we took a different approach than some of the conventional wisdom out there, and it's paid off eventually. But it's actually, you know, the result was that we had a really long development cycle. Some things that I'm hearing from the floor, people coming up to me and saying, you know, you got the thing running on the Cyberstorm, but, you know, on the Amiga One, that's going to be a different matter. It's going to be at least 2 more years before you got it running on that. I mean, that's, I don't know where that rumor comes from, but I have to squash it right away. So Kermit just mentioned the Draco. Now, the Draco didn't even have the chipsets. So, you know, all these people are thinking that it's going to be a major challenge to untie the operating system from the chipsets. I don't believe it is. And our developers, and there's 30 of them, and I want to thank each and every one of them for their dedicated hard labor. I don't think even the Chinese could extract that kind of hard labor from anybody. So anyway, so they've been doing a sterling job, and they've been telling me there is a lot of grunt work that still needs to be done to get OS4 running on the Amiga One. There's three main areas where the chipset used to be originally in the operating system. You had the kernel itself, exec, which relied on the 68K CPU and to some extent also on the actual chipsets. Now, as you know, we've completely rewritten the kernel, and that has been shown to be running on the Amiga One hardware. So that's not a problem anymore. Secondly, we got all the devices, IDE, parallel serial timer device. All of these need to be re-implemented, because they all use the original custom chipsets. They need to be re-implemented for the Amiga One hardware, and that's a bit of work. I won't deny that. We're already working on it, not full pace, because we're actually trying to finish OS4 first. I mean, you know, we're not going to start on two things at the same time. But it's highly modular work, and it's certainly nobody's going to win a Nobel Prize with that work. I mean, a serial device, a parallel device. I mean, yeah, you know, maybe Jens Schilfen can tell us more about it, but it really isn't rocket science to write a driver for that. So whilst it is a lot of work, I believe it can be done in a reasonable time frame. And I'm very confident that going forward through the year, that we'll see more and more software actually running on this ever-increasing number of Amiga One-related products that are becoming out in the next few months. And as that hardware comes out, our ability to expand the market also and push it into different niches, including multimedia systems, setup boxes, kiosk systems, all kinds of hidden functionality where people don't even realize they're running Amiga OS. But who cares? I mean, if you come up with a solution that works and you can sell it and it doesn't require a lot of maintenance and it does its job, nobody is going to care what operating system it is, except for, of course, for us, who will know that that kiosk system is running Amiga OS, and that setup box is actually running in the Far East, is making use of Amiga OS. And that's actually one of the, in closing, that's actually another one of those fine symbiotic things we've got going on with Mai. They have a lot of connections in China, mainland China, and also in Taiwan. And also with companies like IBM, Motorola, and so forth. They've been in business for a long time now. I believe they started out as Mentor Arc Inc. in 1995. So that's just 1 year off the Commodore folded. So they have a good lead in those markets in the Far East, and I think that a lot of the future for the Miho is actually out of the established markets where Microsoft has a stranglehold on the market, and where there's still a space for us for the Miho to excel and become the product that everybody wants it to be. So once again, thanks for your patience, and I'm very happy to see you all here.
Thanks a lot, Ben. So, we've heard about the Amiga One now. Let's take ourselves a little side trip here, and let's invite Jens up here.
Yeah, I've been telling you all about my hardware today, and the thing I want to introduce today is something brand new that only very few people know about. It's a software thing. You may all know that I'm mainly into the hardware, but this hardware doesn't work without drivers, and thanks for the reference. I always have to buy these drivers from other programmers because I can only do the hardware. This software thing that I want to talk about is a research project that I'm doing together with a German university, and it's for the Catweasel. The Catweasel floppy controller allows very low-level access to the floppy disk, so low-level that you can do a lot more than just reading a standard disk. I want to do this from this overhead projector over there, because I want to write down some things and show you how the Catweasel works. Do we have some file for this? I don't want to write on this glass. Anyone?
We did ask for that. We did ask for what you're asking for. So, somebody probably has it in an office, and we've gone to go get that.
Okay. I'll try it without the projector for this time. as I said, the Catweasel allows very low-level access to a disk, so low that it goes down to the physical layer, and that is the flux transitions, the magnetical flux transitions on the media itself. And you might all know that the older a disk gets, the higher the probability is that the media gets unreadable, and this is the research part of the project. If a disk gets old and it's maybe not readable anymore in a standard computer, the Catweasel might still be able to recover the data, because there are certain the data degenerates in certain I need a word. Where's the other German guy here? Gesetzmäßigkeit? Yeah, this degeneration of the media is in a certain way predictable, and that's the research part. We're trying to counteract these physical effects of media aging with a piece of software. And the signaling pathway that the software is letting the data going through is completely graphical in this software that we're writing. That means from the flux transitions, it's a graph builder. That means you take little modules that you build a signaling pathway meaning you do the decoding with a GCR decoder first. That way you you have converted the flux transitions into ones and zeros, and after that you decode these ones and zeros into GCR data, and after that you try to extract the sectors out of this data, and then you interpret these sectors as a filing system. And at the end of a whole long chain of modules that you all put together in as a graphical piece on screen, you have a window that shows the files that are on the disk, and you can handle this like Directory Opus or the Windows Explorer or whatever. This this whole thing is going to be open source, so it can be implemented on any operating system. It's going to be published on Windows first. Sorry, guys, but. After that, since it is open source, we can port it over to Amiga OS 4 or find somebody who's porting it over to MorphOS. So, and of course to Linux, because those guys are the first to port anything that's open source. And the nice thing about it is being open source and fully documented. It means that a lot of other programmers can write modules for it. So, for example, if somebody knows, okay, this disk has a certain kind of special low-level format, but all the other levels are the same, that is, the file system, for example, or the sector sizes, the sector encoding or something, that's a totally different level. If somebody else has already implemented that, it is just a graphical block that you take out of the existing software that you have, and just take this other special thing to make a new signaling pathway to decode and then save a disk that was previously not supported. I mean, most of you are here are Amiga guys. You all know this concept of the mount list, where you can combine certain devices and file systems and that way generate new media. Then this all might sound familiar, but this graph builder is a little bit more flexible than the mount list thing, because it can go even further. You can cut the signaling pathway anywhere and insert special features in it. Of course, you can always monitor the data that is going through there. There's a monitoring module that you monitor and edit the data, can edit the data in. So remember, we're talking about aging disks here, disks that are somehow bad. And of course, although the aging is somehow predictable, it's not always easy for to write a software that can tell, oh yeah, this bit must have been a one, or it must have been a zero, or whatever. This monitoring module allows human interaction to recover the data. Of course, there are keywords like fuzzy logic to implement on these. And that's what we're also going to try. Use fuzzy logic to try to recover the data, just on a try and error basis, and maybe also a neural network that learns how how this media aging is taking place. And yeah, that's the low level stuff. Then. On a higher level, on the file system level, it gets really interesting, because once you recovered the files, you have some pieces of data. But let's say you had something from a word processor, and you want to use that data in some final writer program today. Try to load it with the Amiga. It's probably not going to work, because the file format is totally different. Now, the signaling pathway after the file system interpretation is not is not ended there. You can add another module, which can be a converter, for example. So if you have some file from a text processor, from the word processor of an Apple II machine or of an old C64, then this file format can be converted into another standard format, into rich text or into whatever, or a Koala Paint graphics from the C64 can be converted into BMP bitmap or IFF graphics or JPEG, whatever. So this signaling pathway that can be edited on a graphical way is really from the low level, from the flux transitions up to the to the point where the data is interpreted and converted into a piece of data that can be used today and in a way that it can be archived. Archiving is the next keyword. This it's not only a German university, the Fachhochschule Köln, which is involved in this, but it's, this project is also of great interest for the Internet Archive, which is accepted or I think even registered as a library here in the US, and they take care of archiving websites. For example, they have this Wayback machine, maybe you know it. You can watch websites on the net, how they have been on a certain date, and they have 20,000 disks that they want to archive, and they are going to be big contributors to let this software evolve and to give us lots and lots of input to let this software learn and to let us learn about media aging and how to recover data from such disks. And they're also going to take care about some legal stuff. This is not yet settled completely, so I don't want to talk about that yet, because the Digital Millennium Copyright Act gives us some problems, but they're about to be solved. So, yeah, that's about it. Okay, let's at the end. Yeah. Yeah, you want me to draw the diagram or?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, the signaling pathway starts at the flux transition level. I'll try to illustrate it with just what kind of pen is this? I didn't want to paint it. Okay, I'll try to illustrate it with north, south. Just imagine this is, thanks. This is the,
well, there's several other.
A little better. I'll try it with this thick one. This is the lowest level, the magnetic flux transitions. Then it goes over to a GCR or GCR or MFM or FM or whatever else. There are so many different low-level encodings on a disk. I don't want to write them down, but these are the choices you have here. Then it gets down to the sector encoding or decoding. After you got the sectors, you got to interpret that data somehow, and that's being done by the file systems. And after the file systems comes the part that gets really interesting, to use the data on today's computers, and that's the file converters. I I really love to have another pen. And all these stages can be cut, and at these everywhere where I have an arrow here, the signaling pathway can be cut, and some monitoring or editing device can be inserted, and after. And the other thing is, all these modules here, they are simple single files that can be spread over the internet, and anyone can add to the list of these. All these modules, these arrows, they all point down. It's not 100% correct, because all these modules can talk back and forth. That means if the file system discovered an error that is a dead link or something, some file that is incomplete, it can report this error back to the sector decoder, or even back to the GCR decoder, in order to take special actions to find and correct the error. And to be precise, those arrows should be pointing up and down, but I don't want to draw too much this. It's going to look totally different. It's going to be graphical. Those modules are little squares on the screen. You can draw the lines between these modules in order to tell the computer how the signaling pathway is going to be, and how these modules are going to talk to each other. And if it doesn't work, then the program is going to tell you. Usually all these modules can talk to each other directly and exchange information. So if you want, you can have all the user interaction that you want, the full control, or the other way around. If you do not know anything about a disk, but you want to find out what it is, you can just let those modules act on this on the disk and try to find out what it all is. Most of these disk formats that we are doing the research on are somehow known. That means we know the media itself. We know the drives. We know how fast that they have been spinning, and we know the capacity of the disk. And that's how we are trying to get the information about. How did they record it back then, and how can we speed up or make data recovery a little easier? But there are also some disk formats that are totally unknown. That some systems that might have been used back then, but nobody really knows about the hardware. And one nice thing was the Ohio Scientific Challenger. Ohio Scientific was the company. The Challenger was the brand name of the computer. It's a computer from 1977, and these disks were completely unknown. I mean, no controller. Also, the Catweasel. We couldn't do anything with that data, except for reading these magnetical flux transitions. And the only thing that helped us in that case was the schematics of the computer. That because the computer didn't have a real floppy controller chip, it used some weird serial chips and some analog circuit behind it to have it somehow encoded to be written to a disk, and as a big exception, the schematics of the computer helped. Usually, other information helps, like what kind of floppy controller chip was it, or what capacity was the disk, or is the disk. That is usually how we recover the data. And that's about it. I mean, if you have a disk, you can try by exchanging these modules. You can try to get hold of the data somehow. And recover anything that you have at home, even if it's unknown. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Question. Yeah.
How long would it take for this to be implemented? to save the questions for the question and answer period.
Yeah. Okay, then. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. No, sit down. Sit down. It's a panel discussion. We have to be up here. Well, as everybody's probably discovered, Jens was born apparently with circuits in his brain. This is probably the only environment I've heard the word flux used outside of a Back to the Future movie. Okay, well, I think next I'd like to invite up here the second most famous female in this community after Amy the Squirrel. She's a little more real and a little more creative in her own right. Jerry Ellsworth.
Hi. Well, about 3 years ago, I decided that I was tired of all these modern PCs and how you couldn't get down to the hardware level like what Jens does here and just like play with all the circuits and stuff on it. So I decided that I wanted to try to make my own computer, but kind of base it off the old Commodore 64s, because I was pretty interested in those when I was a kid. Or actually, I was pretty fanatical about those. And so I started doing some research and seeing what was available at the time for parts and different technologies to build such a computer on my own. And I found this company called Altera that made this programmable chip that you could, make your own circuits, put it inside this chip, and kind of emulate anything you want in this chip. I mean, that would fit, I guess, as the size. So I started doing some research on the Commodore 64 and kind of started figuring out how all the, internal circuits worked inside of it, and made a little prototype board, because I was going to try to do the video chip first, because I figured that would be a kind of a fun place to start. So I got one of these chips and just with tons of wires had it hooked to an old Commodore 64 and yanked out the old VIC chip inside, which was the video controller, and came up with this circuit and programmed it into this chip and had this video controller that just made all kinds of random colors and really didn't do the Commodore 64 graphics. And anyway, I heard about this Commodore 64 Expo that was coming up in Chicago, and I decided that I wanted to take this prototype thing that I was working on, even though it wasn't really working, and show them what I was doing, see if anyone was really interested in it at all. So I show up unannounced to this computer show and just walk in the door late, of course, and late in the day, and said, do you have a spot for me? Someone might be interested in seeing this, but I really don't think they would be. But, I'm making this video controller for a Commodore 64. And all these Commodore 64 fanatics just went nuts. They're like, you're doing what? You're crazy. And, pretty soon I had like 50, 60 people just like suffocating me all around this this messy wire prototype, and turned it on. And, there's rainbow colors and sparkles and stuff on the screen. And they're like, oh, wow, ooh, and wow, and like, how many colors can it do? And I was like, well, I figured that 4,096 would be a good place to start, and like, compared to the 16 colors that the original C64 had, they were just like, wow, we could do anything with that, and I kind of did a little talk, and I was like, just talked about the possibilities of what one of these programmable chips could do, and I was talking about, you could put processors inside these chips, and you could design your own special video, and you could basically just build a computer around one of these chips. And then that eventually I wanted to make a portable little tiny C64, just something that you could kind of hack around with like the old days. And boy, I went home from that show, and my email box was already full. I don't know how this word propagated through the whole internet, but it's just email was pouring in all over the place. And what was funny is like half of them were like, quit doing these practical jokes on us. You're never going to do anything like this. You're lying. And the other ones were like, you know, can you add all these extra features to it? You know, this is really cool. I'd like to buy one. I was like, wow, I didn't think I was going to make more than just one of these things. And so eventually, you know, I just from suggestions from different people in the, you know, different vintage computer communities, I added just little things to my project. You know, first it was stereo sound, and then it's, well, we'd like to have PCI and compact flash and IDE, and so I started researching all these different protocols and interfaces, and started making little cores that go inside this chip to interface to those different parts. And well, 3 years later, now I have a ATX motherboard that has PCI and stereo sound and can do 16-bit color depth and 1280 by 1024 graphics and, you know, sprites and all kinds of stuff. And so that's basically how I got here. Recently, Jens, I really didn't have any money to go ahead and make a production run of these, and Jens stepped up and, you know, invited me over to Germany, and I spent like 6 months over there.
Five.
A long time anyway. Eating lots of sauerkraut and, you know, looking at just in amazement at how big the beer cans were. Yeah. And we put together this board, and we have some you can see here today. And there's also a lot of people have jumped on board with this to help out. A lot of people doing freeware software for this thing to get it going. Like we have some people in Sweden that are making drivers that can control the IDE bus and talk to CD-ROMs and PC formatted disks, and other people are stepping up, offering their help to make other parts of it, like other cores to do other interfaces to it and stuff. So I think that's about it.
Thanks a lot. Well, last but not least, I'd like to invite up Bill Buck of Genesee, and Bill is going to talk to you about Pegasus, MorphOS, and the plans that Genesee has.
Thanks, Kermit. I wanted to thank the Sacramento Amiga Computer Club for allowing us to come and participate in the show. We're glad we came. I think only one of us came from California. Everyone came from somewhere else, so thanks a lot. We're your newest members, by the way. We joined today, so we did. Yeah. I also want to thank Steve and his pretty little daughter who got her head stuck in a chair today. If it wasn't for Steve, we wouldn't have had an address to send the computers that we brought here, and we certainly wouldn't have been as organized as we were, even if we weren't. So, but we thank you, Steve, for your support. We really appreciate it. As I looked around the room this morning and I saw some of the, let's say, more mature members of the club, I felt like it was important to remind Brian that I did program my first computer with batch cards. So I can relate a little bit to some of this, and I also learned Fortran before I learned anything else. So, yeah. We have Pegasus machines in 34 countries now, and there are 16 operating systems that are either running or being ported to the Pegasus. We've taken this approach because we understood that not only in this community, but in some of the other communities like the BOS community and some of the more, technically oriented Linux communities like Gentoo, that there were groups of developers that were looking for an alternate OS platform that would allow them to do things that they couldn't necessarily do with the other things that might be available in the marketplace more commonly, like PCs and Apple computers. So from this small production run of something like 612 Pegasus machines, as I said, we've been able to get them out in a lot of countries, and we've been able to get a lot of people working on the machine and making what's working on the machine better. We've sort of from the very beginning thought, at least from what we were trying to do, that the more people that could get their hands on a machine and do something with a machine, the more opportunity there was to make the platform something exciting for an increasingly and progressively growing number of people. We had some bumps along the way. I think those are fairly well known and don't need to be repeated here. But we're looking forward very much to bringing the next round of the Pegasus machines to the market. We ordered originally for the first one 1,000 G3 CPUs, which of course we didn't use all of, so we have those that are ready to go, and most of the components that we did purchase for those machines we'll be able to use in this next production. And we've also ordered recently 200 G4 CPUs that are the same one that was mentioned earlier. We've made about 20 of those cards so far. We've discovered some problems in having those work exactly with our boards as they have today. We've made, of course, those issues and all the issues along our rocky road public. And I think this has, in some ways, created some interest and sympathy maybe in the things that we've been trying to do. But it's been good because we've found support where we didn't expect it, and we found solutions where we didn't suppose they would come from. Also in the course of that whole process, of course, we got up MorphZone, we got up the MorphOS developer connection, we have an SDK now, we have tools that people can use to make things. Of course, the Pegasus PPC site is running now and gets us a lot of good attention. We've had an increasingly growing number of emails on a daily basis from people that aren't necessarily in this community, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. We're trying to build something and create something new from what was there, either if people were somewhere else or they were here first already. So that's been a good experience for us. Looking forward, as I mentioned this morning, we fully expect that these additional machines that we'll be beginning to produce in September will allow us to sort of bring in the next echelon of users. We think that we have to sort of take advantage of this Linux wave that is changing the face of computers. In the same way that Linux is affecting Sun, it's benefiting companies like IBM. And we think that in the marketplace where we're headed, that IBM making a commodity CPU is something that could be very exciting for all of us and bring computing back from, let's say, the synchronous things that are happening in an x86 environment to the asynchronous things that are happening in a PowerPC environment, and that can allow us to do a lot of things that we can't necessarily do today, especially when things start going to 64 bits and the 970 starts rolling out. And you'll see us making a Pegasus machine with a 970 and using let's say the supporting components that will allow the transfer rates to occur at the levels that they can occur. We have a 64-bit kernel under development right now. It's not MorphOS, but it is a 64-bit kernel that's being developed exclusively for the platform right now. Of course, it can go anywhere later. But that'll be used not only for that particular operating system, but also for the BOS, the Open BOS development community, which we're growing increasingly close to. Not surprising, since many of those guys came from the Amiga world before they went to where they went to. As we think a little bit more about MorphOS, I did get a little bit of a kick from Raquel, just as a reminder that we have spent over just on licenses for MorphOS over 100,000 euros. And that, and we'll continue to do that as we build up the flexibility and functionality of the operating system. Just because we're interested in all these other operating systems and development communities doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. The MorphOS is really a core resource of the company and a core technology of the company, even though we don't feel that it's completely ready for a commercial release to a broad public audience. We do feel like over a period of time it will be. And timed with the 970 release, we certainly hope that MorphOS will be in a position to go out and be the Trojan horse that we've been talking about in not only on the computer but potentially to the Mac environment, because we do intend to develop a bootable CD for MorphOS that will run on a Mac. And of course that begs a lot of questions, especially here in the United States with the EULA issues. But as some of you know, doesn't necessarily work that well in Europe, so, and maybe in some other places. So we're going to crash into that one headlong and see what happens and take our chances with that. We found that by sort of taking that approach, we maybe creating a little controversy, that we do get some attention, and that's not necessarily a bad thing when you're getting people in a world that's 90-some-odd percent PC-based to take a look at your platform and think about you seriously. So we're definitely running in that direction, and we're running pretty hard. I think I'm going to forget about the rest of this stuff and just go to the questions and answers. But one of the things that I do want to say is that we do collectively as a group. Need to think about changing the way that people think about computers and what makes a computer a good one or a bad one. We're sort of mesmerized by the megahertz myth, let's say, and we need to think about computers in terms of work and power, and not just, you know, work is the force that's required to displace an object a certain distance, and power, of course, is the amount of work that you can do relative to time. Well, as we think about computing, we should start thinking about it that way. I mean, if Raquel and Bill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water, all right, if we go up the hill, the amount of work that I have to do because I weigh twice as much as her is twice as much as she does if we get there at the top of the hill at the same time. But if she runs ahead as she's known to do and she gets there twice as fast as me, the amount of power that we have is the same. How powerful we are. So if we start thinking about computing the same way, and we start thinking about what we can do with a computer and not how fast we run around the block versus how much work we actually get done, then we might have a novel approach, and that might create a little bit of a stumbling block for some of our bigger competitors. So with that, I'll be quiet and I'll join the panel. Thanks a lot.
Well, thanks, Bill. All right, now if people could, if you haven't passed your questions already up here, I'd like to get the slips of paper. If any questions have occurred to you, feel free to continue sending them up here. We won't keep this going forever. There's probably people planning parties out there. Thank you. Planning parties, purchasing kegs. Okay, maybe on the other hand, you all don't write any more questions. Let's see. You're really handsome. What's your phone number? Oh, okay, that must be for you now. Okay, let me go through these here real quick. I wanted to try to organize everything, at least so that they're in the same orientation. Okay. Thank you, Joe. The question is to the panel, Torx or Phillips? Well, as you can tell from the panel here, we have Jerry, Jens, We have Ben and Bill. There's nobody named Torx or Phillips up here. Peter Torx couldn't make it, and my buddy Phil, he doesn't care about Amigas, unfortunately. So, and no, I'm not going to ask that one. Let's see. With Windows, Mac, and Linux in the mainstream, do the panelists believe that there is any room for the Amiga or Morph OS?
Actually, the answer is no, let's all go home.